Hey everybody, welcome back to Latina to Latina. For this episode, I flew across the country from Miami to meet a fellow Cuban who is getting a lot of buzz in Hollywood. I'm talking about Gloria Calderon Kellett, the executive producer and co-showrunner of Netflix's One Day at a Time. I even got to visit her office at the Sony Pictures lot, which, to be honest, is like most offices, except that in the buildings nearby, crews are taping some of America's favorite TV shows. This rare one-on-one gave me a glimpse into what makes Gloria special, how her mind works, and how her sense of self and her creations are rooted in her upbringing. We're in your offices.
We are.
Sony Pictures. I got sort of emotional walking up to your office. This is such a big deal, Gloria. Like, do you remember every day how it's a big deal?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure I remember every day. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I don't get an email or a tweet or something of somebody like, can you help me? And it just speaks to still the deep hunger in our community and how it's really difficult to find that first job and to find that first leg up. And I do a couple of calls a week, like mentor calls. What I'm always leaving the call with is, it's going to be okay. It's going to take a minute. You know, remember that my overnight success was 12 years. Yeah, no, not a day goes by that I don't feel so grateful that for whatever reason I was able to break through a very difficult industry, and it's been a really fortunate journey for me. I'm wildly grateful.
What do you see as your first big break?
There's so many, right? There's like 20 big breaks that happen along the way. I mean, Mark Reisman gave me my first job. That was a really big deal. He was kind enough to sit down with me.
For someone who doesn't know Mark Reisman.
He was a writer on Frasier, and when I first got an agent and manager and I just didn't know anything, I said, I just want to sit down with a showrunner, any showrunner. And he was kind enough to have coffee with me. And let me tell you, now that I am a showrunner, I don't have time to have coffee with anybody. Yep. It is impossible when you are trying, especially with mommy guilt. So now looking back, what a huge deal it was for him to take time out of his day to have coffee with me. I'm so grateful. And during that coffee, I asked him every single question I could think of. And he was kind and answered. And then he got a show on the air and then hired me. So that was my first way in, was Mark.
And that show was?
Quintuplets on Fox. And on that show, I met Carter Bays and Craig Thomas, who went on to create How I Met Your Mother. We got on beautifully, and they hired me on that show, and I worked on that show until I had my daughter. And then after that, I went to Rules of Engagement and Mixology and Devious Maids and iZombie, and I really got a chance, which is also kind of rare in Hollywood as a television writer. You're usually caught in a genre. And I was able to do multicam, single cam, 1 hour drama, and 1 hour procedural, which is rare. And the great thing about having done that is that at the end of it, I was like, first of all, I think I'm a comedy person. If I was on the fence now, I'm not. And I love multicam. I love it.
Even though people complain that it feels dated?
There are certain multicams I cannot watch. But I'm a theater lover. So for me, the best multicams make me feel like I'm watching a great play in an audience.
So for someone who doesn't know what a multicam show is.
A multicam show is shot in front of a studio audience. It's mostly three sets like there would be in a play. And everything that is recorded is actual live recording from the audience. It's not canned laughter, which some shows do, which is a guy that brings in a box that really with the sound of laughter and they just add laughter to scenes. That's what we had to do on How I Met Your Mother because we had a 3-day shoot. So that was canned laughter actually. But on many multicam shows, it's a live audience. So for me, the theater experience is what I love.
I had not realized until I was preparing for this interview that you have two kids. And
yeah.
So it was in an interview with you and Tanya Saracho where she was talking about, you know, and then Gloria went on maternity leave. And I was like,
I keep them out of the press on purpose. Right. My husband's a cartoonist. We've both decided to live very public lives. And so we want to honor that our kids are their own people. So yeah, most people don't know we have kids.
But what was interesting about that is, like, how did you know it was time? I mean, did you have a hard career to get into? And then you're, like, actually hitting your groove. How did you know it was time to have a baby and that you could step away from work for a little and that there would still be room for you when you got back?
It's so interesting. I always knew I wanted kids. I thought I would wake up one day and go, today is the day.
Same.
Today is the day I am ready to be a mother. Then didn't happen. It just didn't. I just was waiting for that to happen. It didn't. It really did not happen for me. And I think there's a, I want women to talk about this because I've talked to so many of my friends who are like, when did you know? And it's like, you don't know. For me, I didn't know. I knew that that when I pictured my life and when I pictured my aging life and when I pictured everything in what I wanted from this life, it included children. So my husband and I mean, also we were together 7 years before we had kids. It's not like, you know, we weren't bored of each other. It wasn't like we needed to add a new character to this sitcom because it's dull. It was like, this is good. I don't know. I like this. We really sat down and said, well, I guess like.
How old were you?
I was 32. I was like, I mean, listen, I'm in my 30s. Like, what are we doing here? And we were like, well, let's just like try, right? Let's give it a try. And in terms of work, I just felt like I don't want to stop my life for things I want. It's going to work out. And I'm going to create a life that's going to make it work out. So I didn't feel the pressure of I'm going to lose my career if I have a family, thankfully. And I was at How I Met Your Mother at the time, and those guys were so sweet, and I felt supported. So it didn't occur to me. It was difficult, and both times I got pregnant, there were complications with work, right, that I didn't anticipate. But I was really glad that I did the thing I wanted to do and didn't let that stop me.
Yeah, what I found most surprising was after I had her, how I just thought, like, I am a machine. I have worked my entire life.
Right.
I love work. Work is my baby. I'm going to have this baby. I'm going to have my other baby. And then all of a sudden I had this baby and I was so in love with her. I mean, like, obsessed. Like, it's hard to understand until you go through it where you're just it's like the first 3 months of a relationship for the rest of your life.
Right.
You're just like, I just want to be with you all the time.
Yes.
And then I had to go back, and it was harder to go back both for me and you know, I'd lost some of my heat. Like, there is some reality to stepping away and then going back and having to reintroduce yourself and being a mom when you reintroduce yourself, because, like, in our society, it's not cool to be a mom.
Yeah. No, I would definitely say the hardest part was returning and feeling like I had to be exactly who I was before.
Which you're not.
It's
like a bomb went off to your self-identity.
So I was really grateful. I took a year off after I had my daughter.
Same.
And I just developed. And that was a gift to myself. Yeah. It was hard to leave How I Met Your Mother. I loved that show. I loved those people. But it was ultimately a very good thing that I got to just sit and be and heal and be a person. With my son, I went back to work 8 weeks after having him. And I should not have done that.
Were you nursing?
I was nursing. I was pumping at lunch. I was pumping in the room because I was at DV's Maids at the time.
Okay.
And I overheard a coworker saying that it was not fair that I was taking extra breaks in the afternoon to pump.
Stop.
So I was like, I'll pump in the room.
You're going to see these boobies.
Then here we go. Well, I was covered. I mean, I didn't do it out in the open. But yeah, I was like, all right, then I'll pump in the room. And it was interesting. I had a lot of, at the time, it felt like a badass move, right? And I felt badass every time I did it. Like, screw you guys.
Especially
here I
the
am.
Sound of that machine. Like,
yeah, because it kind of put everyone to sleep because it's a little bit, you know, it's kind of like a sound machine. But later on, I felt guilty about it because I was like, have I set up the men in this room to expect that nursing mothers have to pump in the room? I hope I didn't. And it's the guilt, but we carry this guilt, right? No matter what we do, there's guilt. There's a guilt. So yeah, that was too fast. I didn't feel healed. I didn't feel really emotionally ready.
Two is different than one.
And I was also, there was a mad commute. It was an hour and a half over to Disney and back. It was taxing for me. It was a taxing situation.
You started your career acting.
I did.
Still an actor. Going to be on season 3, which everyone is very excited
about. Yes, I know.
And I've heard you talk a lot about sort of standard fare, that you would go on interviews and auditions, and because you were Latina, it was like, do you want to be gangbanger girlfriend number one or gangbanger girlfriend number two?
Right.
And so,
or prostitute sometimes, if I was lucky, there'd be a
little
prostitute.
Diversity.
That'd be fun.
And so in part, your writing was motivated by the reality that there needed to be more roles for women like you that were our actual life experience. Not that those aren't life experiences,
right.
But there's a broader diversity of life
experience. Yes, I also feel like we've heard that story, right? Mm-hmm. That's not a new story. That's the same story. And based on, you know, Annenberg, USC, they do all these great studies. And what America sees of Latinos on television is largely criminalized. And that's dangerous. It's just dangerous. If you live somewhere where you have no experience with Latino people, and what you take is what you see on the news or what you see on television, you're going to form, of course, a very afraid, very fearful, very, who are these people? I don't understand them. I just worry about that so much. I worry about it so much, especially when it comes to policy and things like these children being held in cages. I understand that it's easier to close your eyes and ears to that if you have dehumanized that experience. And so the humanizing of that experience is what is very, very important to me in all the work that I do.
So talk to me about you got a call that Norman Lear wants to do this show.
Yeah.
And is there a part of you that's like, no me diga?
I mean, listen, I remember exactly where I was. And it was like, what?
Where? Where were you?
Oh, I just left a spin class. I say that because it makes it sound like I spin all the time, which I wish I did. I don't really anymore. But I had to like level myself on my car because I was like, what? And then immediately my thought was, I don't know if he should do it, but I'm not going to not meet Norman Lear. Like, yeah, I'll go to that meeting, of course. So I went and I tell people, like, the first 30 minutes, I couldn't tell you what happened because I don't know. I was in a what's happening and there's freaking pictures of him with presidents and you're like, what's going on? Then he really puts you at ease. He's a walking little love ball. And he's sweet and he's curious and he could very easily sit in his beautiful mansion and put his feet up because he's done plenty in this life. And he doesn't. He lives with such purpose and immediacy of wanting to tell stories about our common humanity.
I realize for people, I should just back up and say Norman Lear, legendary producer.
Legendary
One
producer.
Day at a Time is a show that you are now show running, but was originally a show of
Norman
Lear's.
Yes, but most famously, I would say All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Maude.
Yes. Was really incorporating sociocultural issues into his work before other people were doing it.
Way before anyone else was doing it. People were doing sort of silly sitcoms, and he was doing really socially conscious sitcoms where people were talking about real things.
Woke before people were woke.
Yep. That's right. That's right.
And so then when you get the offer, do you just say yes?
No, I talked to him. We talked for a long time, and I felt comfortable enough to say, I'm not sure you should do this. And he said, why? And I said, because the Latino experience, we're hard on work. We're hard on it. And I think we're hard on it because there is a starvation in our community for actual representation. Right. So when something exists, all Latinos want it to represent them, but it can't possibly, right? So then what happens is instead of getting really specific, I think networks and studios in the past sort of do a pan-Latino thing that ends up being worse. And then you're out, right? It feels like someone got in there. It feels like a stereotype and you're out. And he's like, well, what would you do? If you were divorced, what would that look like? And I was like, well,
I don't want to entertain that.
I said, well, my parents come to my house every day. Literally, my dad just walked into my house to pick up my kids to take them to camp. My parents are a humongous part of my life. So if I got divorced, they'd live with me, 1,000%. And then he was very like, what's your mom like? And I started talking about my mom. I said, picture Rita Moreno, because I've been saying that my whole life. When I talk about my mom, I say, picture Rita Moreno. And they go, oh, okay, that's my mom. Little feisty fireball. He goes, oh, I'm friends with Rita. That's great. We can call Rita. So at the end of the meeting, he just said, well, let's do that. Let's do that show.
Okay, so let's talk about it because you're my first Cubanita, because I am self-conscious about the fact that I am Cuban. And I was like, I can't stack this thing with other Cubans. So first, let's talk about your family story. Both your parents come during Pedro Ban, and they end up in Oregon.
Oregon.
So I'm a Jersey Cuban, and I'm married to a Miami Cuban. But I don't know anything about the Oregon Cubans.
Listen, the Cuban diaspora is huge because of that influx. And then the Mariels, I mean, there were so many influxes, right, of Cubans coming in.
To this day.
So to this day. So they're plopped all over this country. And so, yes, the largest, New Jersey and Miami, are the two hugest populations. But there were churches that would take in many Cuban kids all over. So for whatever reason, both my parents were in a group that went to Portland, Oregon. There were Catholic Charities that took them in, that fostered them, and that helped my family until my grandparents were able to come over, which they did. Both sides were able to come over. Wow. And then they settled in Portland. So they lived there for the majority until I was 14, and then we moved to San Diego. So I grew up in a very Cuban community in Portland. All the people I knew were Cuban. These are the days where everyone said tío tía, and you're not really tío tía, but that's what you're calling everyone.
But what does that look like? Because in one of the things that's different between Jersey and Miami is like I think the proximity to Cuba makes it different, where it's like the politics are real in both places, yes, but it's still just so much more raw in Miami. So what was it actually like? Like, did you grow up speaking Spanish? Did you grow up eating Cuban food?
Yeah. Yes. I grew up speaking Spanish and eating Cuban food. And I mean, every birthday party is 100 people. I grew up with all of that and all the Cuban, everyone knows everyone. Everyone's, you know, the Radio Bemba's alive and well. And, you know, like, it was great. But also, the only Latinos I grew up with were Cubans. That was the thing that was different. When I moved to San Diego, I was like, what? There's Whoa, other people? Yeah. That's crazy, because the only Latinos I knew were Cubans.
And I have to say, growing up, I didn't know there was such a thing as Latino. So like I grew up in a very diverse place, but still like people were Cuban, Puerto Rican, Colombian. Like no one referred to themselves as a Latino.
Right.
But it really, all of a sudden, like I remember my mind just exploding.
Yes.
When I was like, oh, there are more of us? And yes. Oh, and we're a minority?
Yes.
I had no idea.
Oh, believe me. No. Well, also listen, the biggest thing I noticed when I moved to San Diego was my Mexican friends would be self-conscious about speaking Spanish, would be self-conscious about their skin color, would be self-conscious. And I was like, what? Like, there's nothing about the Cuban experience that I grew up with that was self-conscious about anything. My parents led me to believe that being Cuban was my superpower, and it's what made me maybe better than other people. I mean, not joking. So it was interesting because I feel like my being Cuban, I didn't have a negative experience growing up until we moved to San Diego and I started seeing my brother, who's darker, experience stuff. But he experienced stuff because people thought he was Mexican. And I was like, man, what's going on? Why is everyone so hard on these Mexicans? What's going on? It just had never occurred to me how different people are treated right. differently. And also the colorism in our own society, because growing up, like you said, yes, in Oregon, we were never Latino. In Oregon, we were Cuban. When I moved to San Diego and I realized, oh, there's a bunch, and then you start being one of many and you want to sort of be inclusive of them, then I started referring to myself as Latina.
I bring it up because I have to imagine it was a tension point for you in your reality as being Cuban. So you decide that the family, in One Day at a Time, modeled after your own family, is going to be Cuban. But you do that with the knowledge that we're a minority group within the Latino population of the United States.
I would say the inclusion of the parent character is what made it really something that was passionate for me. When you're talking about having an older person on the show and having the Lydia character on the show, I just was like, there's so much about the Cuban experience that I can tell through her that I would love to do. I just, the specificity of that, honoring my grandparents, honoring my parents, I would love to do that. And so I told Norman and Mike Royce, my partner on this, I said, you know, look, at some point they're going to ask that they be Mexican. Watch. And they did. And to Norman and Mike's credit, they said, listen, this specific story, we're trying to be really specific. We're hoping that specificity will actually be more universal. We'd like to keep them Cuban for this show. And to Netflix and Sony's credit, they said, okay. So I was able to tell those stories. I was able to do a Shea t-shirt story. I was able to do the Pedro Pan story many times. I was able to do immigration stories through the Cuban perspective. That was really, really important to me. And so I'm really grateful.
Did you know you could do this job before you started doing it?
I thought I could, yes. And then I love it. It's my favorite job. I love being a showrunner. I love saying yes or no and fighting for things. I think what people also don't know in the grand scheme, they don't know how many fights there are. It's a lot of fighting. Like, I have stopped fighting with people on the internet when they quibble about some small thing here or there because they have no idea the journey of getting one Cuban show on television. It's hard. So, like, let good things be good. Let good things be good.
Yeah. When I read your Wikipedia page, what I love about it is you've done every job. You've done everything in every medium. So award-winning plays, web series, short films, sketch comedy groups, every writer's room. And now you get your moment. What is the closest you ever came to quitting?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, for a minute, it was a daily thought. It was. Because I think the thing that makes me very emotional about being on this show is not only do I have a moment, but I am very supported. And I can't tell you how important the support is. Mike Royce has healed so much in my heart as a creator because I sat in rooms for years where I would have white men look at me like, why are you here? You're only here because of your last name. You're only here because you're female. What you say is not valuable. I mean, and my experiences in rooms have been fairly positive. I haven't even been in a terrible room. But even I experienced that in a lot of the rooms I was in. And it makes you doubt yourself as a creative person. It does make you go like, oh, maybe I'm not good at this. And then you sort of retreat. And I would start to devise things that, like, what can I do in the room so I'm not crying and I can move past this moment? And one of them would be grocery list, right? So I'd make a grocery list. And I remember one day I was in a room with a guy who was never kind to me. And he saw me making notes and he grabbed my notepad and he saw my grocery list that I was making so that I wouldn't cry because I had just pitched something. And he was like, ugh. It was just like, oh, of course. This was the same guy that after, you know, I turned a script in, he would be like, oh, don't get salsa on the script when you turn it in. And then later was like, hey, it's cool that we make jokes about like your ethnicity. And I was like, well, be accurate because Cubans actually don't have salsa. it was like these little digs that were hard. And the more women would be in rooms, the more lovely, you know, look, there were also a lot of white guys that were awesome. So this is not a anti-white guy. I'm married to an amazing white guy. And by the way, the other thing that I want to say in this thing, I didn't even know I wasn't white till I moved to San Diego because I grew up thinking I was white, 1,000%. We're white. Cubans identify as
and
white.
You are white.
Yes, I
racially.
Am white. Racially.
In a writer's room?
In a writer's room, definitely not white. Definitely not. So there was a lot of times, and I think the thing that fueled me, thankfully, I think, is my parents' Cuban spirit. You start feeling hurt, you double down.
History of them.
So for those of us who are watching you, right, it's just like, on the rise.
Yes.
It's all happening.
Yes.
Like, she wanted to Shonda it up, and it's happening. And it's happening for her, and it's happening for us. And then there's always, like, a record scratch.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't know, what does it take to pitch a show? What does it take to get a show picked up? And then what is it like when it doesn't turn out exactly the way you thought it was going to?
So when you pitch a show, you put together the characters, the world, what the pilot episode is, and then what it is in series. So History of Them was really based on my daughter, who hates social media. So she doesn't want to be on Facebook ever. So the one thing she likes is the On This Day. On This Day, 4 years ago,
that's cool.
Right?
That's a cool feature.
She loves that. And so that's why she allows family photos to go on. So, like, I think Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter, she'll allow a family photo to go on Facebook because she likes being able to look back. And she said, like, it's kind of like a scrapbook, Mommy. And I thought, oh, my God, it is a scrapbook. My grandkids, if they want, will know what I ate on certain days. If I could have this for my grandparents, like, amazing. So the history of them is a daughter in the future tracking her parents' relationship by looking at their social media and putting pieces together. She's heard the stories. Now she's looking back. And so it has a How I Met Your Mother element in that it's somebody looking back. But I also really wanted to talk about how we curate our lives, how fights are happening and then you take a happy photo. All of that stuff that I still feel is something that I would love to explore in series. I also wanted to show a loving Latino couple. It was very important to me. I think especially Latino men on television are portrayed really just as drug dealers and cops and firemen, or as like sexy Latin lovers and nothing else. So to be in a comedy where there's a loving Cuban father was so important to me, to honor my dad, who's like the biggest yummy love bug ever. So this is a relationship of two people that love each other and are in a loving, committed relationship. And they sort of become the parents to this other, to this group of friends. And it's about how these two people meet and fall in love. So I pitched it. It was, there was a bidding war for it, and CBS paid the most. So we did it at CBS. CBS was very lovely to
me. You did it, meaning you shot the pilot?
We shot the pilot. We cast it. The wonderful Anna Villafañe was my lead. And Brett Dyer from Jane the Virgin played a version of my husband. And then their friend group, which was a diverse friend group. So, yeah, we shot it. I had a great experience. CBS loved it. And then at the end of the day, they get to pick four shows, you know, and we weren't one of them.
I know you want to Shonda it up, meaning you want a production company exist on multiple platforms, multiple mediums.
Yes.
What do the rest of us need to do to support you?
Let good things be good. I would say support other Latin creators as well.
What does that look like?
That looks like giving things a shot. It's interesting. I think as a community, we are quick to say no because we've been hurt. And I get it. I think let's try to heal our hearts by seeing that when one of us wins, all of us wins.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. Latina to Latina was originally co-created with Bustle. Now the podcast is executive produced by Juleka Lentigua-Williams and me. Sound edited by Aluakemi Aladusui. Email us at hola@latinatolatina.com. Send us ideas for guests or talk to us about what's on your mind right now. Remember to subscribe or follow us on Radio Public, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you're listening. And please leave a review. We love hearing from you.